Good afternoon. So before we were interrupted by spring break, during which maybe you remembered things, maybe, we were discussing pipelining. In particular, we went from applying pipelining to these sort of toy circuits to actually talking about how we do that in a real processor. And the steps were basically, we divided our processor into stages, and this was the secret purpose of the steps our textbook authors did for the single cycle processor. And we made it so when values cross between stages, they go through pipeline registers. So rather than relying on our ALU to keep outputting the value for the current instruction, we put that value somewhere in a register and let the ALU work on something else. And this gives us an overall setup where each stage reads from the previous stage, writes to the next, and maybe manipulates some state that's conceptually in the stage. Like the memory stage conceptually contains the data memory. It's where data memory reads and writes happen. And this meant our overall execution is we had one instruction in write back, and just behind it was the next instruction in the program doing its memory stage, and then the next instruction behind that and execute and so on. And we talked about a problem after we did all this work, which was hazards, that our pipeline wouldn't work naturally for some sequences of instructions. So, for random instructions, they would not interfere with each other and we wouldn't have to worry, but we had two kinds of special cases. So we had data hazards, where if we did the thing in our pipeline and looked at the values we had, we got the wrong value. And the issue was that we wrote in one stage and read earlier, and that meant that we would end up reading an old version of the value when an instruction which logically is earlier in the program hadn't written its value yet. We had this different order of reads and writes versus what our single cycle processor would have done. So that's called a data hazard. We also have control hazards where we don't know what instruction to fetch. So for example, in a conditional jump, we don't know what the value of the condition codes are, so we can't figure out what to do. And we have a generic solution, and this is a solution which always works, but it's not always what we're gonna do. And that was stalling, that we could always insert no ops to wait for us to know, for example, where does a conditional jump end up going? Or what is that value going to be? We can wait for it to actually be written to the register file and only then read the register file. So this was a generic solution which always solved our hazards. And those are the hazards we dealt with. And we mentioned what happens in each stage. And one thing I'd like to remind you about is we made some decisions here that avoid hazards. That we're resolving hazards sort of by design. So one of them is that our memory stage does the read and write there. Let's say we had like a memory read stage and a memory write stage. Like we made a data memory which could read and write a value at the same time. We'd still have a problem because, well, then we need to worry about what if we read a value before it was actually written, even though in the program the instruction to write it came before, or came in the wrong order. So we have to deal with that, but because we only read and write in one stage, we don't have to worry about that. We always do our memory accesses in order. And there are real processors which don't do that, and they have to have all this extra logic to worry about what if I have a data hazard with two memory accesses? What if I'm reading from an address before I write it? But we don't because we made this decision that we do one memory stage, even if that might not be the most convenient thing besides if we ignore hazards. And similarly, we have our condition codes, which are read and written and execute, and we said we made that decision, so we don't have to worry about hazards with the condition codes. We don't have to worry about reading the wrong version of the condition codes, because the only time we read them is in sequence. We always read and write in instruction order. We never read condition codes and fetch and write them and execute, which would have us have to worry about whether we're actually reading the correct version. So with stalling, we have these costs. So we have a couple extra cycles for every return because we need to wait for the memory stage to finish to know what to do next. We have a couple of extra cycles for every conditional jump because we need to wait for the condition codes to be available so we know what instruction to fetch next. And we have data dependencies where we need to wait for the write-back stage to finish. And depending on how long that takes, we could wait up to 3 extra cycles. And this worked, but it has this pretty high cost. And this cost is actually really high as far as our processor performance. Like, we wanted, by having 5 pipeline stages, to get roughly something that's 5 times faster. But if we stall these times, we're going to have something much slower. And the biggest reason for this is our data dependencies here. If you think about like assembly code you've typically seen or written, usually you're like adding to a value then using it immediately afterwards. And we're saying that every time you do that, that costs up to three extra cycles. That's pretty annoying. So the question is, can we do better? And we're going to look at doing better, what we can do for each of these. So I'll start with the first one, since we'll just dismiss that quickly. So for return, we don't have an easy solution. Real processors do things, and we might discuss it very briefly later, to make return faster, but we're not going to, when implementing our processor, we're just going to say, well, we can't really read memory early. So if we did anything, it wouldn't always work. We'd have to still deal with the case where we had a call, then a return, or like a write to where the return value is, and then a return. Right after each other. So the worst case, we still have to wait. So there's not an easy generic solution, though, as I said, real processors do things which make return usually faster, but they have to handle this special case still. For data dependencies, we're going to talk about this trick. We're going to use values that aren't being written back yet, but we've computed. And the key observation is going to be that we have the value ready because we've computed it, we're able to write it, except it's just not at the register file yet. But we have all the information about the value already available. And this happens very frequently. A lot of the time, when a value hasn't been written back yet, it's somewhere in the pipeline waiting to be written back. We've already done the work to know what that value is. It's just not stored in a way where you have an easy way of getting to it. And what we're going to do is we're going to add a way of shortcutting that value from wherever it is in the pipeline to where we need it. So to give a more concrete example, this is our old data hazard we had. We read R8 and R9, add them together, store it in R9. And then we read R9 and R8. And we discover that when we do that, we end up not actually reading the correct version of R9 because it hasn't been written yet. So here, just the value that ends up going into our decode to execute registers here is the wrong value. And that's because we had our 900. But we can see that if we look later in the pipeline, well, right on here, we just added it. We computed the value. And if only we could steal this value here, the value we're sending to that next set of pipeline registers, we'd be fine. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to take that value that's going there, and we're going to add a wire so we can send it back to replace that 900 we read, which was wrong. So we're going to fix the wrong register write we had by adding a shortcut. So what's happening here, if you look at our simple add queue only processor, is we read R8 and R9, you get ready to do that, and we've read the values for instruction 1, so we have 800 and 900. Then we add 800 and 900 and get 1700 here. And at the same time, we are reading 800 and 900, 900 and 800 from the register file for the second instruction. But we know that this value here is wrong. And in fact, it should be this value. So what we're going to do is we're going to add a one. Just going to add a connection where we, instead of using the value from the register file, we're just going to take the value that's about to go into that pipeline register. Now, of course, we don't always want to do this. If my second instruction was add R10 or 8, if we did this, we'd get the wrong answer. And usually it's the case that we don't have this sort of conflict. So we're going to need to make a decision. We're going to need to decide, do I want to use this value from this shortcut extra wire, or do I want to use the normal value from the register file? So we're going to add a mux. So sometimes we're going to end up choosing the value from the register file. We're going to let that pass through the mux, and that's going to be what we end up adding in the next cycle. Sometimes we're going to take the value that was just added and store it as the value to add in the next cycle. And you might observe, well, we could have used R9 not as RA, but as RB. So maybe our next add instruction was add R10 or R9. In that case, we want to take this 1700 and not forward it to replace the first register you read, but to replace the second. So we're going to have a second mux to deal with that case. So any questions about what I'm setting up here? So the key idea is we do the thing we do without a hazard, and then we fix the wrong value by finding it later in the pipeline and forwarding it to where we need it. Yes? We will get to that next. So the question is, what's the mux actually checking for? So the mux needs to check for, well, is this value down here the one I want? Of course, we actually need to concretely compute that, and I don't even have all the information showing that we need to do that. And basically what we're looking for is you want to tell, do these two instructions conflict? So the most important thing to consider is we're comparing register numbers, because if this was R11, R12, we'd have no problems. And that's because we know if two instructions don't have any registers in common, there's definitely not a hazard. So something about that logic is going to need to compare register numbers. So let's go through that. So let's think of exactly what the conditions for this top mux are. It's going to be about looking at register numbers to figure out, is the value I want here, based on the register numbers I can see in the pipeline, versus, you know, the one that should replace what's coming out of the register file now. So I have several options here, and you probably aren't too comfortable with how we name wires. So we're going to talk about what various wires are named in our typical HCL that sort of follows the convention of the book. So we have, if you remember, this is the DE registers, and this is the EW registers. So here, this is EVALE. This is the value that's we're about to send as W value in the next cycle, and that's what we actually write to the register file. And along with that, we have our register number, E desti, and on the other side, we have big W desti, and up here, we have D underscore desti. And like when we talked about setting like the mem read bit value, whether we went to read or write from memory, we needed some extra information, for example, the I code. So we need like pass the I code down the pipeline stages. There might be some other stuff we need to pass in order to do this forwarding correctly about the instruction that I'm not showing at all. So for example, I have this sort of hypothetical WRA, and that would mean that we take RA here and we'd have a register that stores that where we have D underscore RA and on this end E underscore RA, which then goes down here and we get becomes little E underscore RA and big W underscore RA. And that would be a register, a set of pipeline registers we'd add, like the I code, because we needed some information about the instruction. And the only way we can get it is if we have it going through pipeline registers all the way back to the instruction memory. So that would be what the WRA signal here would be that output of that register where we passed RA all the way from the instruction memory step by step through the pipeline. So given that, so for the forwarding path I'm showing, which is taking this value here, this which I call EVALE, and using it to replace the first output of the register file, what should the condition be? And figure this out, check with your neighbor that you agree. I'll check on your answer in a minute or so. Okay, who needs more time? No volunteers for more time. Okay, so who thinks it's 1? 2? 3? 4? 5? Okay, so we have relative consensus that it is C. Okay, and the key thing for thinking about this that I like to do is I remember that you have these pairs of values here, that this eval E and E dash D, they're going to be used together, and then eventually they're going to become the value in the register number we're writing to, just like back here, when we have D dash D and these two register outputs, those are, you know, if everything goes normally, those are going to be the two values we add and where we put the result of the addition. And over here, we have W val E and W dash D. Those are two values, a value we're going to write and the place we're writing it put together. So we want to use the corresponding register number and that value. And in this case, we're thinking about using E val E, so we're going to look at its corresponding register number E dash D, and we're comparing it to reg source A, which is the number of the register we just wrote, which is where reg output A would come from normally. Or register number we just provided to the register file. So in fact, C is the right condition for this particular forwarding path. Of course, we have to do this analysis for the other mucks. And there's some other cases we're going to need to handle. So I showed you sort of the simplest forwarding case, but there's obviously a whole bunch of other shortcuts you can think of. Like, I haven't drawn all the ways of connecting things to just after to replace a value from a register we read that was wrong. Like, there are a bunch of other ways I could do that. So, and for example, in even on this simple only add processor, we also would need to forward values from WVALE. Like, that's something we need to do sometimes, because it might be the case that the value that's about to be written is on the in the write back stage, not the execute stage, at the time you want to replace what we just read. So we're going to need a condition to handle that in addition to the case where it's an execute. So let's look at figuring out some of these forwarding paths. So here's an example of some code, and we have the stages assuming we can execute this without stalling. And it turns out that yes, we can execute this without any stalling and resolve all the hazards with forwarding. I'm just going to tell you that's true. We'll talk about how we figured it out in a second. And we're going to look for systematically where does forwarding need to happen. And to look for that, we're going to say, well, we look at what the output of instructions are, and we say, where is this used? So we have R9 here. So we're going to ask, where is R9 used? Well, that value is read here, it's read here, and it's read here. And we're going to enumerate through those and figure out where we need to forward. So for subq, we're going to say, we want to have the value before execute. So we want it by here. And generally, when we forward, we are going to forward in the same cycle. So we're going to take wherever the value is at the time we need it. And here we need it just before the execute stage, because we're going to use it in execute. So we're going to take that value and steal it from the execute stage, because that's where it is. In the next example, we need R9. You want R9 to replace the value of the register we just read, so we're going to take it from the write-back stage. So this is a subtle case, because you might look at this and say, oh, it's in write-back, so it's written back. That's not how the write-back stage works. Remember that the write-back stage writes the value at this point in time, at the end of the cycle. And ordinarily, we'd be reading the value around here, so you wouldn't have it. So we're going to need to do this forwarding to make that happen. And since we need it just in time for the execute stage, we're going to forward it from the write back stage to the decode stage here. So we can put it in the pipeline register, so the decode stage, so when the execute stage starts, it has not the values we would have gotten from the register file, which wouldn't take the add into account, but the actual correct values. Yes?
Could you have also taken from the subtract line from the second?
So the question is, could we have also forwarded it from the subtract?
Yeah.
So that's...
From the execute, and right before...
So we'd have to do a whole bunch of extra work to that. So one option is you might say, well, let's get it from the memory stage of the subtract. And the issue we'll have is, why do we have a copy of the value still? Right, because it's one we read, it's not the value that's going to be written to anything. But we could imagine keeping around a copy of the value to do that. Typically, we won't, since we have another logical place to get the value. You could also imagine trying to get it from execute, but in that case, we need to figure out what value we need before the decode stage of this rmoveq instruction. And that's going to be a bunch of extra logic, and we don't want to be looking at register numbers that way probably in the fetch stage, because that will make the fetch longer. So this is typically what we do, but yes, the other options are things we could implement, but typically processors don't. Then we have R9 being read by XOR here, and that is fine because we write it at the end of cycle 4 and we read it during cycle 5, so we don't need to do anything to make that work. There's no forwarding to do. And generally, if we don't have to do forwarding to make something work, don't have to do forwarding or stalling to make something work, we won't. So next we have R11. And I will remove that line. So for R11, we subtract R11, and we need it for the MRMoveQ. And note that MRMoveQ, yes, it's a memory instruction, but it needs its values for the address computation by the execute stage. Like, so it is absolutely not an option to do this. Like, that is not allowed, because that's after we have to add 4 to R11. There. So that's another forwarding case, which is exactly the same forwarding case as we had for the add to subtract, even though it's going into a memory instruction. Next, we have R11 from the subtract to the RMoveQ. So observe here that we have a case where both of our register values are forwarded. That's a thing which can happen. It can be the case that we read two values from the register file and discard both of them because we have more up-to-date versions elsewhere in the pipeline. So here, to get the R11 for this address computation, which we need in time for execute, we're going to steal it from the memory stage of the subtract. So the subtract has the value around in the memory stage, even though it doesn't do anything with it, but it has to pass it from execute to write back, so it has to be in memory. So there's going to be some wire feeding a pipeline register which we can wire to our mux to make that happen. So finally, we have R10 here, and this is a value which comes from memory. So even if we had a way of we can't do that even if we had a way of getting the register numbers. We can't forward it from execute because it's not read yet. It's only available after the memory stage. Fortunately, that's soon enough to replace the value we would have read from the register file without any stalling. So any questions on all these forwarding paths here? Yeah.
Does that mean if we had the XOR queue with R10 one instruction earlier, we would have needed to stall?
Yeah. So the question is, if I had the XOR queue where this RMoveQ is, would we need to stall? Yes. That is a case where we'll need to stall. Generally, when we get a value from memory, one in the next cycle, yeah, we have to wait. And generally, what we'll find out, we'll end up doing, is we'll do stalling and forwarding, so we only stall one cycle. But I just, the one case where our five-cycle processor will end up stalling is any time we read a value from memory, which is remember RMoveQ is not the only instruction which does that, and then use it and execute in the next cycle. So something about forwarding that's worth noting is that we have often multiple forwarding paths. So you might say here, okay, so we're writing R8, and this instruction down here is using R8, and well, by the time it's reading it, we haven't written it back yet, so we should forward the value for R8 we have to that instruction. So what's the problem? Why did I make that line red? Yes.
It's written again, second instruction.
Yes.
So the most up-to-date value is from the second instruction.
Yes. So, yeah, this is like, it's a value of R8, it's not the most up-to-date one. And we, in fact, want to forward from the second instruction. So we have multiple candidate forwarding paths, and we want to choose the right one. And this is something when you're implementing a pipeline processor, you're going to need to handle correctly. It's also something I'm mentioning explicitly because it's a real subtle bug. Because, well, this sort of code does really happen. Like, we often like update a value repeatedly, but it's not super common. And if you think about debugging this, if you follow your debugging strategy is let's look at the values for this instruction, well, they're kind of going to look fine, right? You know, you like, okay, our 12 and 8, we have the right register numbers, we try to read our 12, we try to read our 8. Oh, we do some forwarding, yep, that's a value we're about to write to our 8, looks good. And you keep going, and it might look perfectly fine, but in fact, you know, it's going to be a case where you definitely have the wrong answer. And this is probably the reason why our MUX syntax in HCL looks the way it does, why our book authors chose to do that. And remember what they chose to do is that we evaluate the conditions in order. So first we check, in this case, is reg source A equal to EDSD, and then we check, is it equal to MDSD? And because the way our MUXes work is that they check the first condition, then the next one, this will work correctly. This will correctly choose to get the value from execute route memory, like what we wanted to do there. Because we'll prefer the first case if both of them match. So if we didn't have MUXes which work this way, where they always chose the first condition, we need to explicitly write a condition where it's like, if reg source A equals EDSD and, for reg source A equals MDSD and reg source A doesn't equal EDSD, but we don't need to do that because it takes the first one which matches. Does that for us. So any questions about this case? And as you saw in that example, the other sort of multiple forwarding case, which we kind of get for free, is that while both register values could be forwarded, this is not such a big deal. We just need to make sure that, well, both of the values we read from registers, both val A and val B, we're going to need to replace them in case we read the wrong value. We're going to need to handle both of those cases, and sometimes it's going to be the case that we forward something from one instruction and another at the same time. And that's normal, and that's something our processors, in fact, often going to need to do, because often like you manipulate registers repeatedly because you're like accumulating a sum or something like that. Like loading a value, adding it to a sum that you added another value to. There's lots of reasons this happens in real code. So any questions about sort of these ideas of things we're going to do when we write our HCL code to implement forwarding? So I'm going to talk about a more conceptual topic, which is hazards and dependencies. So we call something a dependency when some instruction depends on another, when it needs the result of another instruction. And we call something a hazard if something won't work in a given processor design if we don't do something. So note that dependencies don't care about the CPU. for dependencies, we just care about what does the instruction set say these instructions do. That's enough to know what the dependencies are. It's just like, does this instruction need the result of the other? Whereas hazards depend on the CPU always. And a way you can think about this is that your single cycle processor has no hazards. Like, every instruction just naturally works correctly because it takes a single cycle and works, does the whole thing at once. Like, so that's an example of a processor with no hazard. So everything which is a hazard is because we chose a different CPU design. And we'll have, in fact, different hazards if we do different things with our pipeline. And this is an important consideration as a CPU designer because, you know, when we add more pipeline stages, we're going to change like how much forwarding logic we need. We're going to change how often we need to stall because we're going to change how many hazards there are. And note that we talk, say something is a hazard even if we can resolve it. Because presumably, when we make a real processor, we're not going to have a processor which gives the wrong value. Like, we're not going to do that. So this is even if we do forwarding or stalling, or what we'll talk about after we talk about forwarding today, that is branch prediction, even if we do one of these techniques that fixes hazards and makes it so we get the right value, even ones like forwarding, which seem to have very, very little cost. Like, forwarding is essentially free. We have like an extra mux. So we have the time that mux takes and a little logic that feeds it, but that's actually a very trivial amount of extra time. But even though it's essentially free, it's still a hazard because we needed to add something to make it work. Okay. So, since we know about dependencies and hazards, so here's a bunch of instructions. So tell me, where are there dependencies between the instructions? And some of those dependencies might be hazards in our five-stage pipeline. So the one we're implementing, fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. Which of those are hazards? And which of those hazards are we going to resolve with forwarding? So I would recommend figuring this out on paper, just because I'm really bad at figuring out the timing of instructions relative to each other without writing anything down. And check with your neighbors to see if you agree, and we'll give you a few minutes. Who needs more time? A couple people. Okay. So the way I look about this is I go to each instruction, say what values does it write, and where is that read. So I look at RBX here, and I say, okay, RBX is read down here. So that's a dependency. We know we're using a value that's written, so they depend on each other. Then the question is, it's the hazard. So I look at, if I don't do anything special, where do I write it? And I write it, here's write back cycle, if I start numbering with zero, the end of cycle four, is where I write it, and I read it during the decode stage, which if I number that way, is in cycle five. So we're fine. It's not a hazard, it's just a dependency from RBX, the first add, to RBX in the last add. I do the same process. So I have my subtract. I look at my RCX here. It writes RCX, and then we have I remove Q, which use RCX. And many of you might be really tempted to say that's a dependency, but it's not, because our I remove Q doesn't care what was the old value in RCX. It doesn't actually affect what I remove Q does. And because I remove Q overwrites RCX, it doesn't affect any of the future instructions that use RCX, like the add immediately after the I remove Q. But there is a dependency from I remove Q, which needs to write 100 into RCX and add Q. And in fact, this is going to be resolved with forwarding. So we're going to want to read the value before execute here. And that means we're going to forward it from I remove Q's execute stage, because it's not written back to RCX yet. And if we actually read normally from RCX, we'd have a value older than the subtract for RCX. And next we have R10 here, and that's the path we showed you before. That's the result of the add, and we want to read it at the end of this decode, so we're going to have another forwarding path to do that. Any questions about these results? Yes?
So why didn't we forward 100?
So we did forward 100.
Oh, why?
That is, in fact, this value here. Because we're forwarding what the value we're logically writing into RCX, and that's going to be 100.
Oh, OK. So, well, my question is, why didn't we circle
100? Why did I circle 100? I circle the dependencies, the most direct version of the dependencies.
OK, so we're actually taking 100 in the instruction.
So it ends up being that the 100 from the instruction, now remove Q, goes into a pipeline register,
okay. And
then it goes into another pipeline register, and then it goes into, and then we forward it to replace the value we read from the register file.
But we're
doing that not because it's the number from the instruction, but because it's the value of RCX.
Okay.
And we can think it logically, as soon as we decode the instruction, we know that's what RCX is now.
So we're not taking 100 from RCX, we're actually just taking directly from.
Yes. Yeah, but yeah, the 100 does not come from the register file because it hasn't been written yet. But yeah, it's chosen because it's going to be written to RCX.
Okay.
Yes. Question is, can the sub Q instruction be optimized away? So if you, as a human or a compiler, you can probably do that, yes. Because you know the RCX is ignored. As a processor, we're not going to do that. And in particular, if all you see are these instructions, even if the processor can't do it, because the subq changes the condition codes, and we still need that to happen. If the processor, then sees the add afterwards, maybe you could have some fancy logic which figures out, oh, you have a sub that isn't doing anything, but we're certainly not going to implement that. And I don't think many real processors do, just because typically compilers won't generate code with actual, like, optimizable way instructions like this. So, other questions? Okay. So here's a second exercise with some other types of things going on. And for this, let's assume there's some instructions after the Jani, but it in fact goes to foo, is what I'm trying to indicate. So where we have dependencies and hazards here. No, just drawing some things for later. Okay, who needs more time? So I've just looked at where registers are reused. So I'll start with RBX. So this MRMoveQ reads RBX, and then the add after it, writes RBX, and the add after it reads it. And to think of forwarding, we want to think of, well, where do we need the value? We need it before execute. Where do we know the value? Well, this is value is read from memory. So we don't actually know it until near the end of the memory stage. So that's the forwarding we want to do. And that is not possible. So this means that here we're going to need to stall and forward. That's what we're going to end up doing. Because if we just forward, it's too late. By the time we want to do the addition, the value hasn't been read from memory yet. So we're going to stall and also forward the value. To avoid, if we only stalled, that would work, but we need to stall a lot more time. So then we have RCX here. So RCX is read by this add queue, written by this add queue and read by the next add queue. So that add queue wants to have it at the just before it's execute, and it's available here, so we can forward just the same time, like so, and that can work. So the value's available in time, So we're going to forward from the same cycle just before it's needed, which is going to be as we typically do with forwarding to replace a value we just read from the register file that was wrong. Finally, I have this arrow from add queue to MR move queue, and that's a tricky one. That's not a dependency because, you know, this is only written. We don't actually read RCX. We don't care what its value is. There's no dependency, you know, there. Finally, we have RDX, which is written by the add. So it's available after execute, and we want it in time for the execute of the MR move queue because we use it for an address computation. You might say, wait a moment, you're adding zero. We're not going to be that smart. We're going to want it in time for execute, so we're going to just forward it from the end of execute to the end of decode. So that's the data dependencies, and there's some set of important dependencies I didn't talk about, which are control dependencies. So one thing is that the add instruction sets condition codes, which the jump instruction is going to read. And this is, in fact, something that we can't, that we're going to need something other than forwarding that, you know, something other than forwarding to resolve. Or arguably the dependency where we look at the jump. We didn't make clear about what we consider the exact control dependency, but there's some sort of control hazard here where we need to do extra work so the jump gets the condition codes and figures out what foo, whether to go to foo or what's actually after the jump. And we'll talk about our good solution for that later, but forwarding like doesn't solve it. Because there's not a value to forward. Like, you can think maybe we forward the condition codes, but we don't know them early enough to be useful. Like, it's another case where if we could do it with stalling, you know, that's about it. Okay. So any questions on this before I move on to some other topics? Okay, so one thing I like to mention is that we've been going through lots of examples with our five-stage pipeline, which is the one we're implementing. That's why I'm talking about it so much. We'll get much more familiar with it than anything else, but it's not the only option. And as I said earlier, the pipeline you choose changes the hazards you have. So for example, if I have a four-stage pipeline where I have, say, executed memory as one stage, then some hazards that we had at the five-stage pipeline go away, because we write back values sooner after we compute them. So you should expect to see different hazards with different pipelines. So with that in mind, let's think about what happens here. So let's say I split the execute stage into two stages and assume I can't get the result until after the second one, otherwise why did we split it up? And I need it at the beginning of the first one, otherwise, you know, why did we split it up? So what's going to happen here? So where do I need to do forwarding and stalling? And remember that when we have something where we do stalling for a data hazard, we're also going to do some forwarding so you don't wait all the way for write back to happen. And I would write things down, but you don't have to. I have incredible trouble tracking what's happening at the same time, especially if there's any stalling, without writing something down. Okay, who needs more time? Not anyone volunteering? Okay, so the way I would generally figure this out is by writing out what pipeline stages we're gonna have. So I do the natural thing and I say I'm gonna have fetch instructions one after another, because that's where you wanna start. You're gonna have to adjust that later. And then I look at, okay, so I need the value for this add of R9 at the end of decode. So it's ready for the first execute stage. So that means I want to get it from this previous add here, and that's a problem because this is where it's available. And the solution to this is I'm going to stall to make that actually line up. And that means I shift everything forward. So all the future instructions have to wait. And now, you know, I've waited a cycle, and now that forwarding from the end of the second execute stage will work. So I stalled once, and I forward the value after stalling, because I've stalled just enough for it to be ready for me to forward. I also have this dependency of R9 into the second add. And that I need here, and I can look, it's not written in time, even with the stall. So even though we've stalled the second add by a cycle, because we stalled the third add by a cycle by stalling the second add by a cycle, we haven't delayed enough for the value to be written naturally in time. So we're gonna need to forward it. So we're gonna forward from where it is in the first instruction in the same cycle. Finally, we have our RM move queue instruction. So here, we have two things we need. We need R9, which we just wrote in the second add instruction, and we need that before execute. We need it before execute because we're gonna use it to compute the address, and that we do in the execute step of our memory instruction. We also need RBX. We need R9, I have this wrong. So we need RBX before execute. We need R9 as the value we're gonna write before memory. That's when we need it. We don't actually technically need it for the execute stage because we aren't using R9 to compute an address. We're using R9 to store into memory. But we're using RBX earlier. So RBX, we're gonna end up forwarding from where it is up here at the end of the second execute stage. We look how things lined up, we actually don't need to do any extra stalling. And for R9, we can do this forwarding. And this is a weird case for forwarding that our book doesn't even do, but we can do, is that, well, you know, we could wait until, we could have instead, would be correct if we stalled for a couple cycles and then did it. And then forwarded this value, and then stalled for a couple cycles, a cycle, and then forward it from here. That would be correct way to solve that problem, where we just replace the register red, but we don't have to do that. We can go later in the pipeline, we can say, you have this value you read from a register earlier, and I'm fixing it for you. Obviously, the logic to figure out that you're gonna do that later on is a bit complicated. And that's why I think our book doesn't talk about doing it. But real processors will do this because when you have a long pipeline like this, well, it's worth not waiting an extra cycle when you compute a value and then write it to memory, which is pretty frequent, right? You compute a value, write it to where you're storing it, like that variable in memory right away. And you want that to be fast. So we have these two forwarding operations and no extra stalling is needed as long as we can forward not just immediately after we read a register value, but later on if we don't use it for the first, for like the execute stages. So any questions about this? Makes sense how you figure this out. So yeah. I'd like you to be able to actually reason about pipelines which aren't the one you're implementing, because a lot of people just remember when that pipeline stalls and when it forwards and that's it. Like, obviously, if you're dealing with real processors, they won't all have five stages that are exactly the ones our textbook chose. Okay. Yeah.
On the RBX.
Yeah.
Why do we need to forward
RBX? Why do we need to forward RBX? Because we're going to use it to compute an address in the execute stage. So it's written by this add instruction. So if we just read it from the registers, we have the wrong one. Because it hasn't been written back yet. And we need it by execute. Well, we need it anyways, because if we don't forward it at all, we're going to read the wrong value. Okay. So we talked about forwarding, and forwarding resolved almost all of our data dependencies. Sometimes we still needed to stall. Like, even if we did really clever forwarding where we like looked further ahead in the pipeline to figure out, you know, that, oh, you read this value a while ago, but it's still wrong, which we won't have you implement. But even like, but it solved our problems faster, at least, even in that case. We avoided some stalling, and we avoided stalling in most of the most common cases. Like if we just are doing additions and subtractions, we never stall in our five-stage pipeline. At six-stage one, different story. So we have one remaining thing we're going to talk about dealing with, which is conditional jumps. And our trick here is we're going to guess and check. We're going to guess what the jump does and check our result later. And the reason we can get away with this is, well, let's think about when instructions actually do things. So other than the pipeline registers and the program counter, if we fetch the wrong instruction, harmless, doesn't change anything. If we decode the wrong instruction, harmless, doesn't change anything. And if we start executing the wrong instruction, doesn't change anything. If we finish executing it, we're going to change some condition codes. So as long as we catch the problem early, that we guessed something and we were wrong, as long as we do our checking early enough, we actually have very little work to do to fix our guess. So in particular, if we want to undo an instruction during fetch or decode, we just forget everything in pipeline registers and figure out what the PC actually should be. And forgetting everything in pipeline registers probably means replacing it with a NOP. Because that's, you know, that's our, we don't know what's going to be in the pipeline registers volume. And that's in fact what we're going to do. So the idea is we have some code like this, and the policy our textbook chooses is that when we have a conditional jump with a label, we're going to assume it always goes to the label. That's going to be our guess every time. It's not the best possible guess. We might talk next time about other possible guesses that real processors use. But it's the one our textbook uses. It's very simple to implement, and it actually works pretty well. So we're going to guess that we go to the add queue, and we're just going to, by guessing, we're going to start executing the add queue. We're going to fetch the add queue, we're going to decode it, then we're going to fetch the MR move queue. And if we're right, we're 2 cycles faster. We avoided some stalling to wait for the jump to figure out the condition codes. And if we're wrong, well, we're going to have spent those 2 cycles executing bad instructions instead of executing NOPs, which takes the same amount of time. And we're going to forget about them, so we're not going to change anything. So we're basically only going to be faster, except we have a little extra logic to forget about instructions. But besides that, this is only faster. We can only guess right and help ourselves. If we guess wrong, it's as expensive as it was with stalling. Because it's as if we stalled, except our stalls were a little more complicated than NOPs. So when we speculate right, we have our jump, it goes through the pipeline, and we just put an add, then an error move queue, and I've marked them with a question mark indicating they're speculative. They're guesses, which I haven't verified, but they haven't gone far enough in the pipeline that we're actually concerned about any problems. And during the execute stage, we actually read the condition codes. So we find out in time, before the add instruction actually like writes the condition codes, before the MR move queue instruction actually writes to memory or reads from memory, or so MR move queue writes to memory, we find out whether we were right. And in that case, we just keep going. And in fact, we do less work for the jump than we were doing before. So in the case where we speculate right, our checking is we find out we're right and we don't have anything to do. We just let the pipeline operate like it normally would. The case where we guess wrong, a little more complicated. Yeah. And the advantage here is that previously, those slots there were just, we were doing nothing. So we're doing strictly more work, and it turns out that because we guess right, it's useful work. When we guess wrong, well, we have those slots where we're doing work that's not useful, and we need to do some extra work to squash the wrong guesses. So previously, we passed the rmove queue through the pipeline, the add queue through the pipeline. We need to have some extra logic to say, you just guessed wrong, get rid of that thing that you were about to write to the pipeline register. You have a mux in front of the pipeline register, and you put in a not instead of whatever was there before. And we also need to figure out the correct next instruction to fetch. So this means that part of the thing that goes with this jump instruction is that we need to have the address of XOR. It needs to be tracked somehow. And typically the way we'll do that is by sending it down the pipeline with the jump instruction. This is like we send down the iCode. This is something we need later on that might not be explicitly written down in an obvious way. Yes?
What happens to the stack?
So where is the stack stored? So it's in registers or memory, and fortunately we acted before we changed any of those. So we don't have to worry about anything changing the stack, even if like we had a pop instruction or something. Or a call, yes.
Why was the decision made to choose to take the jump rather than to choose to not take it?
The question is, why did our textbook authors choose to always take the jumps rather than not? So there's two reasons. So one is that it means that handling unconditional jumps and calls is the same as handling conditional jumps for the non-checking part. And two is that empirically, always taking does better than never taking for real programs. Like, this is not obvious, but when people have studied real benchmark programs and things like that, and empirically, always taking is right 60-70% of the time versus not taking is 30-40%. And the intuition behind why this happens is think about how loops would typically be written. You typically want to write a loop with one conditional jump which goes to the top of the loop, and that's going to do better with this always taking policy. But obviously you can write a program where none of the jumps are taken and make it do really bad. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is our branch prediction. So we have a simple policy, we assume it's always taken, and we just do that first, and when the jump gets to execute or memory, that's when we're actually doing some extra logic. We do some extra logic in execute to make sure the instructions get squashed. We do some extra logic in memory to make sure we're fetching the correct thing. And that's how we work. And this is going to actually help us quite a bit. So if we think about some modest idea for how many jumps we have, that we have 8% and our prediction is slightly good, then if we compute sort of cycles per instruction, what you may remember us doing before the break, we do that with this table, we find out that, we are 10% faster. Just by doing this branch prediction. And that's because, our jumps actually take, if we were doing stalling, take multiple cycles. So this is a big impact. And this is with a 5-stage pipeline. It gets much better if you have a 10-stage pipeline, which many real processors do. Okay. So before we finish up, I'd like to talk a bit about some weird things our book does when implementing branch prediction. And this has to do with how our book arranges the PC update. So our natural PC update is we have, a value going from the PC, and we have this mux where we choose to add 2, 10, maybe we have a conditional jump input when we're talking about for the jump target or the call target. We have a bunch of inputs, and we use the iCode to figure out what's going. And you can think of doing what we talked about as far as correcting our misprediction and going back to that XOR instruction in the example that was after the jump, that we have some mux here where we take in the jump target or that value we got later in the pipeline about what was after the conditional jump that failed. Like, we have a bunch of extra cases. And also we have this case where we stall the PC. And that's for return, for example. For return, we're going to have to wait until we get the value from memory. We don't have a good way of making a guess. Real processors do. Well, we might talk about that briefly, but we won't implement one ourselves. And our textbook does this weird thing where they do something kind of like adding a mux here and removing the PC mux. That's sort of what they do. It's not quite that. So what they end up is with something they call the predicted PC, which replaces the PC. So rather than taking the value here, they compute the prediction before the cycle. And our prediction in this case is the jump call target, or plus 2, plus 10, the normal place the instruction goes, or the prediction for a conditional jump. And that's what they store in a register. And at the beginning of the fetch stage, at the very beginning, they do a little bit of computation where they handle the special cases, like getting the address from a return from the memory stage, getting the address after a mispredicted jump for a conditional jump that we found out we guessed wrong on. They could have done it this sort of way, where they did it at the end of the cycle, but they chose not to do that. Both of these work, and all they're doing is they're changing whether this computation happens, you know, at the beginning of fetch in the textbook's version, or at the end of the previous state cycle in the other version. I think the main reason our textbook authors did this is to emphasize that we have a prediction for the PC and make that like a concrete thing. But this often confuses people, and both things would work fine, right? It's just moving a computation from just after the beginning of the cycle to just before. You know, we're just changing where we put that PC register in this compute the next PC computation. But this is what our textbook authors do for to implement branch prediction. And a non-intuitive effect this has is that because we're doing some of the computation at the beginning of fetch, you should be careful about where we get these inputs. So for example, the address from return, if we're substituting it for our prediction at the beginning of fetch, it's for something coming from the write back stage, because we read it from memory in the previous cycle, and we're going to get it from a pipeline register, not directly from the memory, because we're doing it at the beginning of fetch. And similarly, the address of the mispredicted jump, that jump will have now advanced to the memory stage, since in the last cycle we did its condition code computation. And we'll get it from the pipeline registers between executed memory, not from the execute stage itself, which is going to be running the next instruction, probably nops, that we just inserted in the pipeline. That makes sense. And the general pattern this is going to have is that you're going to replace the PC, right? If you follow what the textbook does, which most people do, we don't actually require it. Like, all our pipelining processor assignments are just like, do you take the right number of cycles? Do you have the right values? That sort of thing. But if you do what the textbook does, you're going to replace your PC with a predicted PC, and you're going to have a mux to decide what goes into the instruction memory, where the mux like has cases for like the condition code set take, this is the jump neck jump val p said not taken, but we have all the cases that I showed here. You have the mispredicted jump, you have the address from RET, we're going to deal with all those there. So that's all I have for today. I'll take questions, but I'm out of time, so.